due to the subject matter of today's sermon regarding sexual temptation. Parental discretion is advised.
Okay, so everyone's found Proverbs chapter 6, verse 24 and 25. We're going to read that, and then we're going to read 7, 6 through 10. So let me just read this with you. Well, actually, I'll start in verse 23. For the commandment is a lamp, and the teaching is light, and reproofs for discipline are the ways of life, to keep you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, nor let her capture you with her eyelids. Moving to chapter 7, and verses 6. For at the window of my house I looked through a lattice, and I saw among the naive, and discerned among the youth, some young man lacking sense, passing through the street corner, her street corner, and he takes the way to her house, in the twilight, in the evening, in the middle of the night, in the darkness. And behold, a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot, and cunning of heart. Well, if you remember from last week's message, we switched topics in the book of Proverbs from how to live wisely in relation to money and wealth to how to live wisely as men and women in the area of sexual temptation. And last week, I introduced the fact that this was designed to be a two-part series. Last week was primarily addressed to the men, and this week is primarily going to be addressed to the women. And I suggest if you didn't hear last week's sermon, you need to listen to it because these go hand in hand. And it's important too because as men and women, we relate to one another, and we need to know each other's weaknesses, our strengths, and how to operate, therefore, relationally with one another. I will say this to the parents, too. I sent out a text in the last week to tell people this, but if you have parents in here with young kids and you're not sure that you want them yet to hear the nature of this subject matter, because we're going to get into detail like we did last week, now is the time to put them in nursery downstairs. But if you're cool with your kids' age to hear this, then please keep them up here. Because I'm going to speak to the kids as well who are of age in some pretty straightforward ways. The first thing we need to do, though, is address the context of this subject matter, especially Proverbs 6 and 7. You see, when I read the verses here, the context is that of a married woman looking to break her wedding vows by seducing a young man to commit adultery. So you think, well, and actually in verse 24, she's described as an evil woman. So you might think, how in the world does that apply to us women at Genesis House? Because I'm not exactly looking to leave the service today to run out to break marital vows to seduce someone in Okotoks so that I can commit adultery. Right? It's a pretty extreme context if you think about it. So how does that apply to the females of Genesis House? Well, I wrestled a lot with this in terms of application, and I probably didn't even get settled. Actually, I'm still not always totally settled in this whole thing, but I wasn't settled for a long time in trying to how to apply this to the church here. Again, her behavior is on the extreme side. So what's the principle? Well, the principle is this. It can actually show you to the extreme what happens if you let your guard down as a woman and you don't watch your heart. I mean, that's the extreme side of things. I have a picture here of a grandfather clock. This woman in Proverbs represents the pendulum swung out to the far left. I mean, that's the farthest expression of sexual temptation a woman can go. But somewhere along the line, there's a principle in which we are all tempted in certain ways. Okay? And so, again, I've unfortunately had to deal with this issue more than once in 11 years of ministry here. This has happened in our congregation. But again, from what I know of you, I don't see that happening at this moment and where your headspace is at. But again, Proverbs is letting us in on the difference between what men and women tend to struggle with and where our sort of insecurities and temptations lie. So if you look at verse 25 of chapter 6, it's really clear here. He says to the man, do not desire her beauty in your heart. And he says, do not let her capture you with her eyelids. So principally speaking then, here's what it's saying. Men especially struggle with lust and to desire a woman's beauty in the wrong way, often outside of God's design. The temptation for women, though, is to use their beauty to turn heads, to entice men to notice them outside of what God has designed for them relationally. The temptation is to always want to turn heads, to be noticed for their appearance. Men, it's lusting after that appearance. In addition to this, there's a temptation for women to make her beauty and her attractiveness the source of her significance and identity. It's the driving force behind whether one feels valued as a woman or not. And this is true whether you're married or unmarried. This temptation isn't just when you get married to turn someone's head and to feel like your beauty's wrapped up in, or your significance wrapped up in beauty. This is an issue for women in general, just like lust was an issue for men in general, whether you're married or single. And again, remember the rule of Proverbs. These aren't black and white rules where every single person's on this side and every single person's on this side. What Proverbs is saying, this is generally how life works in the male and female psyche. This is generally what it feels like to be a man and generally what it's like to be a woman. So please, in the dialogue, don't say, yeah, but I know someone. I'm like, you probably do, but generally speaking, this is how it works. But I do want to remind us of one important lesson from last week. As difficult and as awkward as this subject matter might be, it's really important we talk about it. Not just at a church level, but in the family level. Don't forget, in the area of sexual temptation, that four chapters of Proverbs were dedicated to this subject matter. And that worked out to 15% of the entire book. 15%, and I didn't get the chance to check the math, but I would suggest it's got more attention than any other subject matter in Proverbs. And it's obvious that in our culture, this temptation towards women as well, and what they go through, is massive in our culture. I mean, whether you walk into a school, or whether you walk into the mall, or whether you're, you know, out shopping or whatever, this is all over culture. And so we need to talk about this and be open and not embarrassed about the subject. So where do we begin? I think the first thing we should say is simply that the battery's running low. That's the first thing that I need to know. So the first thing we need to know that is God has no issue with women being beautiful or dressing attractively. And so, I'll get there in a second. Maybe I won't. Consider these verses. In Genesis chapter 12 and verse 11, Sarah is said to be beautiful. In Genesis 26 and 7, Rebecca is said to be beautiful. In 29:17, Rachel is beautiful and lovely in figure. Even the men are mentioned in Scripture. Joseph was well-built and handsome, and David had a fine appearance and had handsome features. So remember, this is God's word, and he's telling Moses what to write, and he says, Moses, I want you to write down that who was good-looking in the Scriptures. God has no problem with saying not only the face was nice, but the body was nice. Okay, so we have to notice that and remember that, about how God is okay to mention people's looks. So it's okay to dress attractively. It's okay to seek to look your best. It's not the beauty that God has a problem with. It's her motivation or aim or desire behind the beauty. That's the issue for God. And the issue is twofold. And so the issue is simply that here's the warning. When a woman uses her appearance to entice others outside of the relationship God has intended for her, it's when she wants to lure in somebody or entice or seduce someone that's outside of what God intends for her. You see, what the Lord wants, whether you're single or married, is for monogamy. He wants all of one person's thought life and their and their attractiveness and stuff to be directed towards the person that they're with. Right? That's what he desires. He doesn't want it to go beyond, to just have a free-for-all to everyone else out there. And so the issue again is not that she's attractive per se, but what she wants to use her appearance for. And so in the case of the woman in chapter 6 and 7, she's married, but she wants to use her beauty to seduce and turn the head of someone else other than her husband. And that's where the problem lies. And so she knew the end goal too, right? The end goal of using her beauty in this situation was to entice to end up in a session of lovemaking at the end of during the middle of the night. That was her end goal. But she used the dress as a means of getting him there, but not telling him. And so if you look in chapter 7 and verse 10, what's really important, after it says that she's dressed like a harlot, which is a prostitute, it says there she's also cunning of heart. Well, cunning of heart in the NIV is to be crafty. So where's the craftiness? Again, the craftiness is this, is that she knows the end goal of what she's doing by the way she's dressing, but she's not upfront with the young man as to why she's dressed that way. But she's smart. She knows that she's crafty. She's like, if I dress in a particular way, I know I'm more likely to get him. So she didn't show up on a potato sack, or as the Bible would say, sackcloth and ashes. She showed up with what in that time would have showed the intent, right? Dressed as a harlot. And in that culture, that would have looked differently than, say, ours. But again, it's the fact that she knew that there's a way she could dress to seduce. But the problem, again, was not in even her attire, per se. It was that what she was trying to accomplish with her attire is where she was trying to get the guy to go. And she knew that her dress was going to be a better way of getting him in temptation. Her beauty was a lure. And I'm going to suggest to you, this is the general temptation of all women, whether you're married or single. Of course, it's not to go out necessarily and commit adultery. But it is through your appearance to turn the heads of not just one man, but all men. All men. I was speaking with someone who had spoken to some women who were Christian, singled and married, and just said, can you please tell me what you think as a woman? What's the psyche? And I have to say this, like Stuart, Laurel and I were having a coffee and discussing this, and she started laughing in tears. Actually, she started to tear, and I thought she was crying because of something I said. And then she started laughing in tears because she's like, it's so funny listening to you and Stuart trying to put yourself in the headspace of a woman. And I was like, okay, good, I didn't hurt your feelings. And it was, I mean, we must have gone back and forth for 15 minutes, and she was just killing herself because she thought it was ridiculous. But these are some of the thoughts about what these Christian women said, both single and married, is what it's like to be you when you walk into a room. So these are like paraphrased, but I'm going to get the main message. They said this. When you walk into a room, you want to be noticed and you want to gain the attention, not just with the person that you're with, but by as many men as possible. But you have no intention, actually, of wanting to be with those men physically or even enter into a relationship. So you're not thinking, I want the relationship, but what you're thinking is, I just want to be noticed for being good looking or attractive with my dress. But it's not just the men, it's the women too. You want the women to notice you and think that you are attractive and that the man you're with got the best catch in the room. There's a lot of time, therefore, comparing and sizing yourself up against other women. And especially if it's a room you've never walked into where there's nobody you know. So maybe not so much coming into Genesis' house because you know people and you're comfortable, but if you ever went to a function in which you didn't know anybody, it's important that you know where you rank in the room of strangers. God forbid, these are my words now, you wear the same outfit as another woman who's in that same room with you. Because now the competition is really on. The comparison is really going for it. When I go to the wedding of Blake and Nikayla, I'm wearing the same suit as I did that I wore to her daughter, Jaden. And I'll feel no shame or worry in that. And I expect, Roger, you'll have the same suit on as well. You know what? Yeah. And I won't even compare my suit to yours, and I won't even care. But there will be, if two women walked in, even from the same church, and were best friends and saw it, there might be a giggle, but secretly inside, there's a comparison. There's a comparison, right? It's hard. The other issue is when a woman's appearance becomes the source of her identity and significance. The Old Testament and New Testament speaks about this. So let's look at Isaiah 3. God is condemning Judah, which is southern Israel, for a whole bunch of list of things that have gone wrong. But one of them was the attitude of women with their beauty. Here's what he says. Moreover, the Lord said, because the daughters of Judah are proud, with heads held high and seductive eyes, and go along with mincing steps and tinkle the bangles on their feet, therefore the Lord will afflict the scalp of the daughters of Zion with scabs, and the Lord will make their foreheads bare. In that day the Lord will take away the beauty of their anklets, headbands, crescent ornaments, dangling earrings, bracelets, veils, headdresses, ankle chains, sashes, perfume boxes, and the list goes on. The issue was this. The women there in Israel back in that day were saying this. There's pride attached to the way I'm dressed. And they believed that they were superior to others and that there was a look at me attitude that they wanted other people to have over them that no one else was to receive. So they believe that it, through their beauty and their clothing, would elevate them and rank them above others. God was not happy with this. In fact, he brought super harsh judgment. And here's what's important about this, ladies. It doesn't actually say there that they actually carried out the desires to the issue of fornication or adultery. I was trying to find it. I couldn't find any text to show that they were actually using that to then move into the category of sexual infidelity. It was just the attitudes of everybody, look at me, and wanting to turn the heads of all the men that was an issue for God. And this is important. In 1 Timothy in chapter 2 and verse 9 and 10, he says the same thing to the same issue. He says to the women, I want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves, not with elaborate hairstyles or gold or pearls or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for men who profess to worship God. So again, the issue here is that the problem in Ephesus was that the women were placing more value in their outward appearance than they were on their inward character. And it's not that they weren't allowed to dress nice and look attractive. It's just that they were placing a far greater emphasis on the external opposed to the internal. And so it was a corrective to the women in the church to say, listen, make your beauty about what's on the inside more than what's on the outside. Now, I just want to say this as a man and as a pastor and a dad and a husband. And I want the men in here to listen up, and especially the young boys. You listen to what I'm going to say. You need to recognize the incredible pressures that women face in this culture to be beautiful. You have to understand the enormous pressure on women to be attractive and have certain hairstyles and clothing and so on. Here's why. We've already determined from the scriptures, like Timothy and Isaiah, that women already struggle to tie their self sense of significance and identity to their appearance as it is. There's already a battle going on inside. But what makes this worse is the general habit of men to evaluate a woman's worth purely on looks alone. So what happens is we'll even determine whether it's worth engaging with someone by their looks alone. So I'll talk to her, but not her. And what's my criteria It's not their character I make that determination, not if they're strangers, is it? It's who's the hottest. That's how we make the decisions, isn't it? So the question the woman goes through then is, why should I care about my character when it seems that nobody else does? Even the Christian men, the world, yeah, the Christian men even. Why should we even care? They know that they've been overlooked because beauty is the only criteria alone. And so this combination of the woman's insecurities and the struggle and then the men's treatment of them fuels this massive hamster wheel that you can't get out of. You know, Tim Keller in his sermon on, he did a sermon about how people overvalue sex in our culture. Listen to these staggering statistics. He said, eating disorders amongst women are 3 to 5 times higher amongst women in industrialized nations over poor nations. He also said that you are two times likely more to have an eating disorder if you're college educated than non-college educated. What's he saying? He's saying this: the closer you get to mainstream culture, Western civilized society, the closer you are to attending UFC and Mount Royal and being downtown Calgary, the more you are bombarded with these images and thoughts and lies. That it's all about looks and all of your significance and value and your need to even seduce people is about your attractiveness. This is why, and listen up boys, teenagers especially, this is why I never want to hear you talk about any female in this church or anyone else that you know in a negative way. Don't let us hear you talk about joking about this and that about their looks. They already deal with massive pressures that you don't face. They have massive pressures that you don't face. So you just treat them with respect, and as Timothy was told by Paul, as a sister in Christ. Would you tease your sister about your looks? Well, you might do it once, but if you have good parents, you'll never do it again. If you haven't corrected them, bring them to me. I'll fix them. Okay? And here's the important thing. Proverbs in chapter 31, verses 29 to 30 says this. Many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. He's speaking to his wife. He says, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. So what is he saying? He's saying this, guys. He's saying, I've been married for a long time, and I've learned this, that beauty fades, but character doesn't. Character, obviously, again, we're not saying you can't be attractive. It's not that you can't go after attractive people. It's just that ultimately what will determine the health of your relationship, whether you're single or married, will be the character of the person long term. If they're going to be a life partner, it's going to be the character that makes it long term. I mean, women hate this verse and men laugh about this verse, but we got to read it. Proverbs 21:9 says this, it's better to live in the corner of a roof than in a house shared with a contentious woman. So what's he saying? Beauty is amazing and you guys are suckers and you go after it all the time. But the problem is once you get her, that beauty disappears very quickly if you're living with a battle axe. It's tough. Think about it now, Hollywood, right? You could argue all day long that Hollywood has the best, well, I don't think they do, but someone might say, well, the best looking people live in Hollywood. How many marriages in Hollywood make it? The two most beautiful people in the world are starting off together, and 1 year later, they're divorced. And then they go off with someone else, 1 year later, they're divorced. Why is that? Because they're shallow in substance and character. And the most pretty woman becomes ugly very quickly if you can't get along with her. And so again, God's design is that we, as women, that you look to your character Dress attractively, yes. Again, he's got no problem with being beautiful. But again, it's this idea that we also want to focus on the inward beauty, knowing that that's long-lasting. And men, I want to encourage you to think in the same way. So, what are women to do about the twofold issue? How does one gain victory in this area? Well, the council last week was that men, in terms of dealing with lust, they should solely be a one-woman man. And I talked about what that meant. Likewise, the council for women is to see themselves as being a one-man woman. God's sexual design and relational design is of monogamy. It's about commitment to one person, regardless of whether you're married, dating, or engaged. And so how do we do this? Women, those of you who are married, direct all of your efforts to be attractive and to be noticed towards one's husband. All of your efforts in terms of your dress, your desire to attract them, to gain attention, be directed towards your husband. If you're in a dating relationship or engaged, the same thing. Start to train your mind to think that God's design for me eventually will be to be with this person in monogamy. And so develop your mind, even in the dating stages, to think about one person. A woman named Nancy Demos wrote a book called Lies That Women Believe. Now, I feel free to quote this because it's a woman who said this, not me. Okay? So if you don't like it, you look her up, email her, and talk to her directly. But she made a comment on 1 Timothy chapter 2 about this concept of adorning yourself modestly, which we read earlier. This is what she said. If a wife makes no effort to be attractive to her husband, you can be sure another woman out there will be standing in line to get his attention. Does God still hold him responsible if he goes elsewhere? Absolutely. He's still guilty of lust and he's got to deal with that with the Lord. But the wife didn't help by not and set the table for him to even go there. When the woman dresses up and to be noticed by her husband in a wanting way, God is for that. It's only when she dresses to turn all heads and not just her husband's does it cross the line. And so here's my encouragement to you, is that don't quit in this area. Men love it. We love it when you look good and you make an effort to take care of yourself. Another area that men really desire, which means a lot to us, especially in light of the Proverbs woman, is in the area of sexual intimacy. The woman in Proverbs 6 and 7 chose to express her sexual intimacy outside of the marriage bed. It means a tremendous amount to husbands when the woman desires him and is completely devoted to him in this area. We read this last week, but I want to read it again. Paul's instruction. He says, now, for the matters you wrote about, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife, and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent, and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again, so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. So I spoke to the men about this last week and what that looked like. I speak to the women now. In my entire time of pastoring this church, and just even before that, before becoming a pastor, I have seen a lot of pain in this area for men, in the area of sexual intimacy and marriage. Men often don't feel they can approach their wives because they've been shot down so many times. And the problem is, once we get shot down so many times and on a consistent basis, it's out of fear of being hurt. And we get shot down for so many different reasons, right? It's, I'm too hot, I'm too cold, I'm too tired, I just came back from the gym, right? The list goes on. I'm too distracted, I just want to rest. And it goes on and on. There's so many different things that we can get shot down for. I just showered, I need to shower. Right? Now, let me just say this to the men. Don't forget Paul's instruction to you in Ephesians 5. He says, you love your wives self-sacrificially and lay your life down for her. So I get it. There's a game that goes on, because often women don't want to give their bodies over because they feel that they've been neglected emotionally. And they want to feel emotionally connected to give of their body. And I understand that. So listen, guys, if you're having troubles in this area, consider your own love of your wife and how you have been laying your life down for her. You can set the table for her to want to reject you by your treatment of her. But at the same time, we need to speak to the women clearly here. Because it's important that even if he's not treating you with absolute perfection, that you don't shut him down either. Because you end up in this stalemate, in this chess match, that no one's going to win. The way to break the cycle of dysfunction and pain in marriage is often for the woman to give up her body, because that gives the man hope. And he feels loved by that action. Again, this is really powerful. Paul says, you as a wife do not have authority over your own body, but yield it to her husband. And in the same way, husband, you have no authority over your own body, but you yield it to his wife. So again, it's expecting the same of both genders. He's not having one above the other in terms of God's expectations for marriage. And I'm going to quote the famous Lana Thiessen from last week, because I loved it. Listen, it doesn't always have to be a full meal deal. You can get sandwiches. A sandwich goes a long way too. And I don't want to get into details about that. You figure out what's a sandwich for your own marital relationship. But let me say one hint. Sandwiches are faster to prepare than meals are. Okay? So you guys can talk about that in your own. I would love to be a fly on your wall tonight, man, in your house, and just sit in every family's living room and say, what was the conversation around the table there? Right, but we love being pursued as well. Women, you love being pursued. Like, catch me if you can, right? We love it too. And here's the problem, right? In the workplace, often we're respected. Male and female alike, you know, like, Pat, like, you've been doing such an awesome job lately. Like, I'm so proud of you. Like, you're like a pinnacle player in this company, and it's changed so much since your contributions, right? Women might say, oh, like, hey, guys, like, notice you got a new haircut today. Looking like, it looks pretty good. Like, from the old, like, scraggy muffin you were, right? Or we're appraised and we're respected in the workplace by men and women alike. So we're in essence, they're sort of like pursuing us and sort of like saying, good job, like, we notice you. But then when we get home, we're unnoticed. We're unnoticed and never pursued. And we die inside saying, I wish I could just get the attention of my wife the way I get the attention at work. It's important that you pursue us just like we need to pursue you. I could say a lot more, but we'll move on here. What else can we do to gain victory? Cultivate your inner beauty by strengthening your godly character. This is important because, again, Satan wants to steal your identity. He's an identity thief. And he wants you to focus on the outward appearance as your only means of understanding your significance. But what does the Lord actually say about you? He says, I want the women to dress modestly with decency and propriety, adorning themselves not with elaborate hairstyles or gold, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. 1 Peter 3 says, your adornment must not be merely external, braiding the hair and the wearing of jewelry or putting on dresses, but let it be the hidden person of the heart with an imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit. Now, why 1 Peter 3 is especially important is he doesn't say you have to stop dressing nice. He just says, it just can't be merely external. So yeah, isn't that an awesome verse? He's not saying wear potato sacks to be godly. He's just saying, make sure when it comes to emphasis, that don't forget about your character. And that's really important. Again, remembering Proverbs 31, beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And what does it mean to fear the Lord? Is to know what he has to say to you, and then walk in obedience to it, to choose his way over your own. And that will be expressed in one's character, in one's conduct, and by living out good deeds. The final one is this, dealing with the identity crisis. Deepen your relationship with Jesus Christ. Deepen your relationship. I'm going to let you into a secret about men. Do you know what the sort of repeating thoughts that we have? Maybe not even thoughts, but if I were to say this is a man's insecurity and nail it to the wall, or what men wrestle with, it would be simply this. Do I measure up out there? Do I have what it takes in this lifetime? That's what men wrestle with. Do I measure up? Do I have what it takes? A woman's issue is not that. A woman's issue is, am I enough? Am I lovable? Am I enough? The voice in the head is more about insignificance and insecurity. This is where knowing Jesus is so important, because he loved you 2,000 years ago unconditionally, by dying for you, despite whether you were beautiful or not, before whether what kind of clothes you had or didn't. This guy laid his life down on the cross for you because of his immense, immense love for you. He's saying this, you as a person and in your identity is worth dying for. Who you are is worth dying for just because you're you. Apart from what you wear and how you dress and how much money you have and so on. His riches of his love was expressed whether you had many wrinkles or no wrinkles. And this is what's so powerful. I'll never forget, Rudy Friesen, that was a part of our church before he went to Israel, said this to me privately. He said, Andrew, when I was younger in my life as a man and married and in ministry, I remember praying this to the Lord. He says, I know you're a father. He says, Father, would you teach me what it is to be fathered by you? So Father, father me. And he said he had a really rough dad growing up at home and things weren't always the greatest. And over the years, God had fathered him in a way that restored the identity that was stolen by the way it was lived out in his home of origin. And that's the thing, ladies, we need the Father to father you. That your identity fully comes from knowing Jesus and understanding that unconditional love that he has apart from whether you're beautiful or not, or going through a tough season or not. In glory, like I said, beauty's fleeting. There's no 90-year-old on the cover of Vogue magazine, right? And there's no 95-year-old that I've ever seen wearing Lululemon pants, right? Running around town. Beauty is fleeting, but knowing that Christ loves you apart from anything you wear or any way you look will be absolutely critical. Because whatever you see, whatever you hear, whatever you face, you'll be like, Lord, thank you for your unconditional love for me. And so, reviewing the lessons for today. God has no issue with women being beautiful or dressing attractively. Direct all of your efforts to be attractive and be noticed towards one's husband. Cultivate your inner beauty by strengthening your godly character and to fight the identity crisis, deepen your relationship with Jesus Christ, who loves you. Father, I just give you thanks for your word and how it always has so much to say to us and changes our perspective of the, especially in opposition to what the world teaches and where the world puts its value and its hope. I pray, God, that you would work in the lives of the men and women in this congregation and beyond. And if there's any healing, Lord, that needs to be done, that it would even start today just by hearing what you have intended for us, whether we're single or married, Lord. And I pray, Lord, that nobody walks out of here feeling condemned and like without hope, that everyone who leaves here walks away like encouraged and just like they have a sense of peace over what was learned this morning. And so we give you thanks. In Jesus' name, amen.